honor and the privilege to give the Ward Lecture, and I want to do it not so much about the religious imagination as to attempt an act of religious imagination. My subject is Jesus the Peasant. And I begin with a quotation which is from an unnamed, there's a point there, an unnamed peasant woman from Piano dei Greci, province of Palermo, speaking to a North Italian journalist during an 1893 peasant uprising. This is what she says. "We want everybody to work as we work. There should no longer be either rich or poor. All should have bread for themselves and for their children. We should all be equal. I have 5 small children and only 1 little room, where we have to eat and sleep and do everything, while so many lords, signori, have 10 or 12 rooms, entire palaces. It will be enough," she says, "to put all in common and to share with justice what is produced." So my talk then will have an introduction, I think it's 4 parts, and then a conclusion. The introduction I call General Purpose and Specific Method. The study of the historical Jesus is now over 200 years old, and it has usually been described in terms of finding the Jesus of history rather than the Christ of faith. In his 1906 book, The Quest for the Historical Jesus, Albert Schweitzer surveyed its progress up to that time, and he distinguished 2 types of searchers, and I think his distinction is still valid right up to today. There were, first, the dogma haters, the anti-theological ones, the Jesus of history versus the Christ of faith group, whose, quoting him now, "hate sharpened their historical insight. They advanced the study of the subject more than all the others put together," he said. But there were, second, the dogma lovers, the pro-theological ones. The Jesus of history equals the Christ of faith group, I'm quoting him again, who found it a cruel task to be honest. It was fortunate for those men that their sympathies sometimes obscured their critical vision, so that without becoming insincere, they were able to take white clouds for distant mountains. For myself, with a religious sensibility that usually prefers both and to either or, and recognizes the paradox in that preference, I never formulate the problem in terms of the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith. That is not my terminology. I formulate the problem like this. What did the historical Jesus do and say in the late 20s of the first common era century that made some people say, "He is criminal, let's execute him," and others say, "He is divine, let's follow him"? How could people look at the same Jesus and disagree so completely? If you cannot explain both those simultaneous reactions, you cannot explain the historical Jesus, who was historically both an object of condemnation for some and of adoration for others. That formulation avoids the Jesus Christ dichotomy with its twin extremes of pro or anti dogma, theology, or faith, which simply skews the discussion in opposite ways. So the method I use to discipline my answer sets out to start on a totally new basis. My method is hierarchically but interactively interdisciplinary. The key word is interdisciplinary. And can best be visualized as a base template with various transparent overlays, which always let the template and each other show through. The basic template is cross-cultural anthropology. In other words, I start completely by forgetting all about Jesus as it were, with overlays of history, archaeology, exegesis, and finally iconography. I deliberately do not begin with the exegesis of the Jesus tradition, but get to that only after those preceding overlays are already in place. Tonight what I will do is take you through the first four stages of that process. I leave you to read about the fifth one, iconography. This is a commercial message. In my recent book, The Essential Jesus, Original Sayings and Earliest Images, which is just out from Harper, San Francisco. So then, the first section is anthropology. I'm subtitling it Agrarian Empire and Commercialized Peasantry. And please understand me, do not think I'm not talking about Jesus. In one sense, I always am. My basic templates in cross-cultural anthropology can be called the Lenski-Kautsky model, since it combines Gerhard Lenski's 1966 book, Power and Privilege, A Theory of Social Stratification, with John Kautsky's 82 book, The Politics of Aristocratic Empires. Lenski divides human societies by technology and ecology into hunting and gathering, simple horticultural, advanced horticultural, agrarian, and of course industrial societies. Within that typology, the Roman Empire was an agrarian society whose forged iron plow and harnessed animal power resulted in a vast agricultural surplus. Such societies had nine classes, but with an abysmal gulf separating the five upper from the four lower ones. Put bluntly, there was a lot more there, so there was a lot more there to take. On the one side of that great divide was the ruler and the governing class, who together comprised about 1% of the population, but controlled not less than 50% of its income. Next, the retainer and priestly classes at about, say, 5 to 7%, ranging from soldiers and generals through scribes and bureaucrats to priests and prophets, all united in service to the ruler and governing class, but also always dangerous as the font of military or moral rebellion. Finally, the merchant class, who evolved upwards from the lower classes. Now, on the other side of the great divide was, above all, the peasant class, the vast majority of the population, around 75%. As high as two-thirds of their total crop may have gone to support the upper classes. Below them was the artisan class of landless peasants, clean and unclean classes, and finally that terrible term, the expendable class. Average between 5 and 10% of the population in normal times. One fact, concludes Lenski, and this is the key thing I take from him, impresses itself on any observer of agrarian societies, especially in a broadly comparative viewpoint. That is the fact of, he has it italicized, marked social inequality. Without exception, one finds pronounced differences in power, privilege and honor associated with mature agrarian economy. Or in my phrase, there was more to take, so the elites took more. Now I'm crossing that basic template from Lenski with the following from John Kautsky. And you'll understand, I'm just giving you the heart of the matter. He adds a very important element. He says, and he's talking about Lenski, Lenski's agrarian societies include societies where merchants have become so powerful that they are no longer purely traditional, this is his distinction, traditional but commercialized like the Roman Empire. So he distinguishes between traditional and commercialized like the Roman Empire. Put bluntly, in a traditional agrarian empire, the aristocracy takes the surplus from the peasantry. In a commercializing agrarian empire, the aristocracy takes the land from the peasantry. They make money the old-fashioned way, they steal it. The former, a traditional empire, devours their industry and productivity. The latter takes also their identity and dignity. Commercialization moves them in increasing numbers down the terrible slope from small freeholder to tenant farmer, advantage of Kautsky's distinction has to do with peasant revolts, rebellions, uprisings, etc. His thesis is that such events pertain much more to commercialized or commercializing than to traditional agrarian empires. Quoting him, peasant revolts seem to break out within a century or two of the transition from a traditional to a commercialized empire. What's the main index for the change? What are we watching? Land becomes alienable and a commodity only under the impact of some commercialization, as happened in Greece, in Rome, in the Chinese and medieval Europe. In the traditional agrarian empire, a familial inheritance is something never to be lost by the peasantry. But now, land becomes, in a commercializing agrarian empire, an entrepreneurial commodity to be exploited by the aristocracy. Peasants in traditional empires generally live in resignation and passivity. They assume that life must, as it has always been, stay the same. No practical question of any substantial improvement ever arises. Only the changes which commercialization brings makes them begin to think about change in general. Having suffered adverse changes, they can demand favorable ones, and I'm still quoting Kautsky, by the way. These may now go far beyond the restoration of older forms of exploitation, all the way to utopians. That's all from Kautsky. Now, what I like about using this model is they're not the least bit interested in Jesus. So they may be totally wrong, but they're not wrong because of Jesus. They're simply laying out the expectations you would find in the Roman Empire as moving slowly into a commercializing empire. More and more pressure on the peasantry. So that's my basic template in nutshell. Let me lay now an overlay on top of that of the history. Roman Empire and Jewish homeland. How does Roman and Jewish history look as a transparency placed interactively on top of that template? Where exactly does that general, and it is no more than general, cross-cultural anthropology and specific Roman imperial history, where do they intersect? In a word, urbanization. Two sections underneath this history. First, the age of Augustan peace. In the Mediterranean world of the first century, Roman civil war from Julius Caesar against Pompey to Octavius against Antony had ended as Octavius emerged victorious to become Augustus Princeps, first among equals with all the equals dead. That peace meant increasing commercialization and even a boom economy, at least as far as the ancient economy could ever boom. But as we all know, a boom economy booms not alike for all. That commercialization was carried especially by the growth of cities. That's how it was done. Now watch as anthropology and history come together. The Lenski-Kautsky model already emphasized the function of cities. And notice that it's not a very benign description. He says another important characteristic of agrarian society was the regular and widespread parts of urban communities. They never constituted more than 10% of the total population, and in some instances were only 5%. Cities as 5%. But despite this fact, the residents of urban centers usually dominated agrarian societies politically, economically, religiously, culturally. I'm quoting him now. All the more advanced agrarian societies resembled a tree or plant with a system of feeder roots spreading over a vast area, tapping the surplus and moving it by stages to the ultimate consumers, the urban population. At the outer limits of this system were thousands, even hundreds of thousands, of small peasant villages, each typically containing a few hundred residents. He just described Nazareth, of course, not even thinking. On the one hand, there was a steady flow of goods from the peasant villages to the urban centers. In return, the villages received certain services of a political, cultural, religious, educational, commercial nature. Basically, they were essentially symbiotic, but with definite overtones of parasitism. I think that's fair. The villagers did get something back, of course. But then slaves always get something back from their masters, too. This relationship was parasitic, this is his phrase, to the extent that the military superiority of the urban-based elite forced villagers to yield more of their crops or to accept less in return than they would have if the two parties bargained from an equal political strength. Villager participation was not simply a function of coercion, but the relationship was just a little less than parasitic. And that's what he says about cities in general and villages. Cross that description with these comments from a bunch of scholars during an 1987 consultation on city and country in the ancient world. And remember, none of them are thinking about Galilee. That's what I like about it. So they're not prejudiced one way or the other. The city, wherever it existed, was the basic unit for tax collection. That's from one scholar. From another, urbanization is the unmistakable result of Roman control. Roman control was urbanization. And finally, the empire is seen as a checkerboard of cities, each with its own set of dependent communities. Just as the power and wealth of the individual landlord depended on his ability to extract rents and profits from his tenants and workforce, so the power and wealth of each city depended on the extraction of taxes, rents, and dues from its own network of villages and settlement, while Rome itself, of course, depended on the extraction of taxes from the provinces. Those quotations prepare us for two very different views of Roman imperial expansion within a commercializing empire. The first is the view from the top down. And it's not a false view, it's just a view from the top down. It's in Virgil's Aeneid, written between 29 and 19 before the Common Era, to celebrate the origins of Julius Caesar and his adopted son Octavius from the human being Anchises and the divine goddess Venus at the Trojan War way over 1,000 years before. He says, "The Trojan Caesar comes to circumscribe empire with ocean, fame with heaven stars. Julius his name from Julius handed down. All tranquil shall you take him heavenward, in time laden with the plunder of the east, and he with you shall be invoked in prayer, and grim with iron frames, the gates of war will then be shut." Magnificent poetic propaganda for the deified Julius Caesar, to be sure, and also for Octavius Augustus, now Divi Filius, son of a divine one. That was the view from the top down. Here is what it looked like from the bottom up. In writing a biography of his father-in-law, Agricola, governor of Britain between 77 and 84 CE, the aristocratic Roman historian Tacitus, with very great credit and honesty, had the rebel general, the Scotch rebel general Calgacus, describe the Roman Empire just before his fatal encounter with its military might in northeastern Scotland. Here is how it was looked from the bottom up. Robbers of the world. Now that earth fails their all-devastating hands, they probe even the sea. If their enemy have wealth, they have greed. If he be poor, they have ambition. East nor west has satisfied them. Alone of mankind, they covet with the same passion what people have and what people don't have. To plunder, butcher, steal these things they misname empire, they make it desolation and they call it peace. Now notice in all of this how politics cannot be distinguished from religion. Is the divine ancestry of the Julian clan a political or a religious claim? It is of course 100% both. When Julius Caesar, for example, came back with the spoils of Gaul and built the Julian Forum just to the northwest of the Roman Forum and put in there a temple to Venus Genetrix, Venus my ancestress, was that a political action or a religious action? In the Roman Empire, religion and politics were absolutely in conjunction. For Caesar, for Jesus. turning from the Roman side of history to the Jewish side. My title is Dreams of the Oppressed. The Jewish homeland had been for centuries a theocracy, a temple state internally under the control of the hereditary high priest. When it passed under the Roman control, originally the south, Idumea, Judea, Samaria, was under a Roman governor directly, somebody like Pilate, for example, and Galilee was under a Herodian princeling Antipas. Both were under Rome. The Jewish peasantry, however, over and above the standard overt, covert resistance that you'd get from any colonial peasantry, had a special ideology of land, which was in direct confrontation with the Roman theory of land as just one more business commodity. It was enshrined in their Pentateuchal laws. Just as God's people were to rest on the seventh or Sabbath day, God's land was to rest on the seventh or Sabbath year. I won't give you the full quotations, they're in Exodus and Leviticus. And the seventh year, for example, you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the poor of your people may eat. Land must lie fallow the seventh year. How did that fit into Roman plans for land? Furthermore, on the seventh or Sabbath year, that is after every seven sets, Jewish debts were to be remitted and Jewish slaves were to be released. How did that fit into entrepreneurial activities from the Roman point of view? Finally, there was even, as I said, a jubilee year, seven sets of seven Sabbath years. In that 50th year, all expropriated lands were to be returned. You shall reclaim liberty throughout the land. It shall be a jubilee for you. How on earth did that work? It is hard to know what is ideal and what is real, what is ideological or actual in all of these. Most likely that jubilee year was not implemented at all in the first century, but the Sabbath year may well have been still enforced. My point, however, is that those ancient laws, precisely as ideal vision or ideological promise, refused to see debt, slavery, or land expropriation simply as normal business transactions. The land is a divine possession, not a negotiable commodity, or as Leviticus put it, the land shall not be sold in perpetuity. God speaking, the land is mine. With me you are all but aliens and tenants. The Jewish peasantry, therefore, in distinction from, say, the Egyptian peasantry, had a long tradition in flat contradiction with a first century boom economy, which saw land accumulation as sensible business practice and debt foreclosure as the best and swiftest way to accomplish it. Didn't have to steal it. What you did was offer loans to peasants who were in liability. You didn't even have to put interest on it. If they couldn't pay the loan back, they lost the land. Finally, now I'm summarizing the work of Richard Horsley. From the death of Herod the Great until the First Roman War, there are constant signs of lower class resistance to Roman imperial power in the Jewish homeland. These are the five groups he distinguishes. Protesters gathered again and again to make unarmed pleas before the second rank Roman governor, such as Pilate, or the distant but first rank Roman governor of Syria. Sometimes they were effective, sometimes they were killed. Prophets gathered large groups of followers and led them out into the desert so that they could cross the Jordan into the promised land, which God would give back to them from the Romans, as of old from the Canaanites. They were expecting divine deliverance and not human violence. They were usually unarmed. God was going to do it. Always they were slaughtered. Bandits increased as farmers were forced off their land through death or disaster and chose the option of banditry in the hills rather than beggary on the roads. Messiahs arose invoking the ancient ideal of David as the once and future king and proclaiming war against Rome in the name of God. It is probably false to see the Jewish peasantry as seething with rebellion and moving inevitably towards open revolt against Rome in that first century. But it is probably equally false to imagine anyone seriously interacting with them and not facing that situation of imperial oppression and colonial resistance. So I've looked at the anthropology, I've looked at the history, and now I'm looking at archaeology. And what I'm really doing is fine focusing in all the time. Gather. Over that, my title is Archaeology, and I subtitle it Galilean Urbanization and Peasant Exploitation. So we already know cities are not necessarily good news for peasants. Rome moves with cities. Galilee. How did Romanization, commercialization, and urbanization look in the roughly 470 square miles of Lower Galilee, rich with grain and cereal on its valley floors, with vine and olive on its hillside slopes? My subtitle, Sepphoris and Tiberius. Sepphoris, about 4 miles to the northwest of Nazareth, and Tiberius, about 20 miles to the northeast of Nazareth, alternated as captains of Galilee in the first century. Sepphoris was burned and his population enslaved as the Romans reestablished control over the entire country in the revolutions almost after the death of Herod the Great. So in 4 BCE, Sepphoris was burned to the ground and then restored, and made, in Josephus' phrase, the ornament of all Galilee. But then, around 19 CE, Antipas built another city on the western shore of the lake in what Josephus describes as the best region of Galilee. So you have two cities within almost 20 miles of one another and almost about 20 years of one another in the small space, less than 500 square miles, of Lower Galilee. Two cities. What are we talking about? I'm basing this now on Jonathan Reed's calculations. Sepphoris probably had about 24,000 people inside a walled city. And the point of the walled city is not that there were huge defensive walls, but that means population density. These are calculated, by the way, by what we can find out about Ostia and Pompeii, which give us sort of the maximum and minimums of walled cities. So about 24,000 people. If you calculate that, it takes all the valleys around them, all the produce of the valleys around them, to feed 24,000 people. Now granted, they're not 24,000 brand new people who have never been there before. But all of a sudden, that does something to land, that does something to food. Tiberius again has about the same, 24,000. So two cities, 20 years, 20 miles, 24,000 people. Now all the peasants are just jumping for joy because that means a theater and they get to go to the theater all the time, right? The obvious and immediate question is, what is the impact on agriculture in Lower Galilee of two cities? More or less new for all practical purposes. This is Reed. In terms of food alone, the agricultural practices of Galilee were completely realigned and stretched with the foundation of these two cities. The picture of numerous self-sufficient farms or hamlets in Galilee radically changed. The entire agricultural focus turned to feeding Sepphoris and Tiberius. And if we could ever get our archaeologists from stop admiring Roman marble and get out into the field and try and figure out what's happening to the limits of peasant farms, we get to understand Sepphoris much better. What would the peasant think of those two cities? Are more and closer cities good or bad news for the local peasants? Now please understand, I'm asking a systemic question. I'm not saying, for example, if some elite person in those cities who wants to get some land and has to have land, of course, takes about, say, 12 peasant farms, that maybe one of those peasant families won't end up the bailiff of all 12 farms. I'm talking systemic. What is a system does that do to peasant life? And I'm not impressed by the fact that some of them will get lured into the city when the building is going on, and when the building is over, will have nowhere to go. I'm talking systemically about how peasant life has been affected. Reed asks that question, but says, how would the indigenous Galilean population react to Sepphoris and Tiberius? The attitudes and sentiments are not discernible in the archaeological record. The Arab, you know, it looked like that. Let me give one example just from another place in the Roman Empire, from Samnium and Lycia. This is again from that consultation of archaeologists on city and country. There's the big distinction. They're trying to figure out city and country and watch the interaction in the ancient world. He says, Romanization, the effects that Roman rule had on the economics and societies of the ancient Mediterranean. He focused on two regions, Samnium, relatively similar regions to Sepphoris and Tiberias. This is in the central Italian Apennines, and Lycia in southeastern Turkey. And he's trying to work out the relationship between three important facets of town-country relations. And notice how the emphasis is shifting. He wants to know not about admiring the marble of the city, but town-country relations. Public building in the towns, settlement change in the countryside, and mobility shown by those members of elite. He says, focusing now on that change, the problem then arises of what this change actually meant in practice for the common people who owned or occupied the estates taken over by the elites. Various possibilities could exist. That the peasants remained on the land as tenants of the larger proprietors, living in poor and squalid circumstances. Now again, he's talking not about Jesus, and I quote him. Or that they left the land to become bandits, or departed the land altogether to go to the city. Now I do presume, speaking systemically rather than individually, that none of those options is a particularly one for the peasants. So I think from archaeology, Romanization is urbanization. And the twin structural elements are elite upward mobility, more and more marble, separate, and peasant downward mobility. So now, we're beginning to see why we might be able to answer this question. Why did Jesus appear in Galilee? When he did, why not in Judea or somewhere else, or in Galilee 10 years before or after? Or specify, why did two movements, the baptism movement of John, the kingdom movement of Jesus, both occur in the late 20s in the kingdom of Antipas? By the late 20s, Antipas was in charge from about 4 BC to about 39. What about the 20s? Now remember, two cities arriving by the year 20 in the small area of Galilee. So now I'm ready to look at my fourth point, exegesis, and I subtitled Egalitarian Vision and Itinerant Program. If you start from cross-cultural anthropology and then move through Roman history and Galilean archaeology towards gospel exegesis, you should be ready for this strikingly obvious question that I've just made. Asked in a master's thesis at Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley by Christopher Seaman. Why in the 20s? What was it special? As a historian, you can't say it was the will of God. You would have to say, what was in that situation that made Jesus peculiar, appropriate to it? The answer of the person who asked the question, Seaman, is that the political, economic, and demographic consequences of Antipas' city foundations generated a new social situation for the Galilean peasantry. He says the Jesus faction emerged in response to that situation, acquiring influence among the peasants by representing their interests. That's a very powerful conjunction of anthropology, history, archaeology, and we're getting into exegesis. Get it wrong, you really have to blow about three or four different disciplines. It's not that it can't be done, but it is more difficult than just blowing one alone. Those renewed or new city elites in Sepphoris and Tiberias would need land in the surrounding country, and that means the possibility of force and violence, of course, but much more the actuality of loans, debts, mortgages, and foreclosures. Between peasants and cities in agrarian empires stands, however, cloaked in reciprocity or masked in mutuality, the presence of raw power and military force. And that helps us understand or even predict a text like you have in Josephus. This is when he's in charge of Galilee in 1966-67, and his peasant levies have only two things on their mind: Severus and Tiberius. And the three words at least he uses: hatred, detestation, and extermination. That's what they wanted to do. The Roman legions would come and maybe they'd be gone by then, but in the meanwhile, couldn't they burn Severus and Tiberius to the ground? Hatred, detestation, extermination. I won't read you the long section from his life, but those are the words he uses. The kingdom of God. The vision of Jesus was that of the kingdom of God, or of the will of God to be done on earth as in heaven. Heaven, however, then as now, was and is in very good shape. It was earth then and now that is and was problematic. The term kingdom of God must be understood within first that absolute conjunction of religion and politics seen above, and second that situation of imperial domination and colonial exploitation also seen above. To take the kingdom of God just as political or just as religious, distinct from politics, is to betray Jesus in one of two different directions. The phrase evokes an ideal vision of political and religious power, of how this world here below should be run if God, not Caesar, sat on its imperial throne. It's a terribly simple phrase. As such, it always casts a caustically critical shadow on human rule. Here is how the world should be run. Now, I need a note in terminology here. I need absolutely some genus level, upper level term, and various lower or species level terms beneath it. And I want to make this clear because there's been so much confusion on this terminology among scholars. And I want to make certain we argue ideas, not just words. As upper or genus level terms, I use more or less interchangeably the following words: basic, fundamental, radical, utopian, countercultural, eschatological. We are speaking of a radical rejection of world, culture, and civilization. Over against the great game's impulsive yes stands the great refusal's implacable no. Now, I use all of those adjectives interchangeably. I don't mean that they couldn't be nuanced, but in general, I take them interchangeably. But insists that while eschatology has etymologically to do with ending of world, such world endings or world negations come in many different forms. So eschatology is my genus level term, and I could use it in the same sense as world negation. For forms, there would be, for example, apocalyptic eschatology, sapiential eschatology, cynic eschatology, gnostic eschatology, monastic eschatology, just to mention the ones I can think of. The former two are of immediate importance: apocalyptic eschatology and sapiential eschatology. Sorry for the big words, but there are important differences behind them. Apocalyptic eschatology announces the apocalypse, the Greek word for revelation, as you know, of imminent and cataclysmic divine intervention to restore peace to a world disordered with injustice. Whether thereafter there will be heaven on earth or earth in heaven is left rather vague, but the evil they will be gone forever, and the holy we will be in charge under God. An example of apocalyptic eschatology's divine revelatory promise is from the ancient world, John of Patmos, and from the modern world, David Koresh. Sapiential eschatology, on the other hand, emphasizes the sapientia, it's the Latin word for wisdom, of knowing how to live here and now, today, so that God's present power is forcibly evident to all. An example of sapiential eschatology's radical lifestyle challenge is from the ancient world, Diogenes of Athens, living in his barrel, and from the modern world, Gandhi of India, living in nonviolence. Apocalyptic eschatology is world negation, stressing imminent divine intervention. Sapiential eschatology is world negation, emphasizing immediate divine imitation. In apocalyptic eschatology, we are waiting for God to act. In sapiential eschatology, God is waiting for us to act. In apocalyptic eschatology, there is private revelation announced secretly to the righteous. In sapiential eschatology, there is public challenge announced openly to the courageous. Both appeal to God and faith, but apocalyptic eschatology speaks in private. Sapiential radicalism speaks in public discourse. The former is the message of John the Baptist, the latter that of Jesus. Both have to do with religio-politics or political religion here and now in this world, but they are different visions demanding necessarily different programs. What I was trying to do there was, as clearly as I can, lay them out without necessarily disparaging either. But I'm turning now to Jesus' program, and I'm subtitling it Free Healing, Open Eating. The aphorisms and parables of the historical Jesus often bespeak a world of radical egalitarianism in which discrimination and hierarchy, exploitation and oppression no longer exist. But was that ideal dream accompanied by any social program? Was it all an act of ecstatic imagination and rhapsodic vision, or did it also contain policies, plans, procedures for communal implementation? If Jesus was a matter of both words and deeds, and we talk only of words, it is as if, to use two American examples, we discuss Abraham Lincoln primarily or exclusively in terms of the Gettysburg Address, and admired, of course, its rhetoric, and Martin Luther King Jr. primarily or exclusively in terms of the Washington Mall speech, and of course also admiring its rhetoric. But in all those cases, there was a program behind the vision, a political challenge behind the soaring rhetoric. It is not just a matter of talk. It is when talk becomes action that people get killed. My conclusion that Jesus had both a vision and a program is based on three independent sources, and that's very important for me, and they are early ones. The first I will quote completely because it's very short. It's from the Gospel of Thomas. When you go into any land and walk about in the districts, if they receive you, eat what they will set before you and heal the sick among them. Eat and heal. Watch that conjunction in all three texts. The second one is from Q, that is, for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of meeting it, when scholars noticed that Mark was copied into Matthew and Luke, they also noticed that there were parts in Matthew and Luke that were not derived from Mark. And they called it Q for quaint. No bag, no sandals, and salute no one on the road. Enter a house, peace be to you. If some peace is there, your peace rests upon him, if not, he returns. Remain in the same house, eating and drinking. When you enter a town, I'm just hitting the key passages, eat what is set before you, heal the sick, and say to them, the kingdom of God has come. Eat and heal. And finally, there is the one in Mark. Take nothing for your journey except the staff. Staff is allowed. No bread, no bag, no money in your belt, but wear sandals. Which is a warning, by the way, that these were serious, because nobody tells you you can wear sandals unless somebody told you before that you couldn't. Said to them, when you enter a house, stay after you leave the place. If anyone wants to see you, shake off the dust. So they went out and preached that men should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many that were sick and healed them. And Mark does not say eat, but he says to stay in the house. Jesus called his practice and program the presence of the kingdom, or better, the rule of God, but that expression should be interpreted primarily in the light of those actions. It did not mean for Jesus, as it could for others, the imminent apocalyptic intervention of God to set right a world taken over by evil and injustice. It meant the presence of God's kingdom here and now in the reciprocity of open eating and open healing in lives that is of radical egalitarianism on both the socio-economic eating and the religio-political healing levels. All three sources indicate that we are not just dealing with almsgiving. I cannot emphasize this too much, but with what anthropologists call commensality, with who you eat with, when you eat, as so far as that forms a miniature map of society. Jesus does not tell them to take handouts at the door. Open eating and open healing are reciprocally linked in all three sources. I understand healing, in terms of Jesus, within the basic distinction made across cultural medical anthropology between those who cure disease and those who heal illness. And I find, by the way, that this distinction was absolutely incomprehensible to my undergraduate students until some of them saw the movie Philadelphia. Now they understand exactly the difference between disease and illness. That the disease is that virus that can be seen under a microscope, and the illness is everything else that interacts with it. Your relationship to yourself, the relationship of the man he was living with, the relationship of his family, the relationship of his law firm, the relationship of the court system, everything to him. That is the illness. It's caused by and reciprocally causes part of the illness by breaking down your immune system. Let me take an example from Jesus' encounter with the leper and try and keep that analogy with AIDS. What are we talking about? We're certainly not talking about leprosy. That's agreed by all scholars. That's not what we're talking about. That was known in the ancient Roman world as Eliphas. You can imagine why. What we're talking with leprosy is something like psoriasis, some kind of a scaly skin disease or rash. Now what's going on here? Legislators seeking to protect a society's status endangered by imperial engulfment in a small society like Israel, not only legislate very carefully about social, national, or macrocosmic boundaries, but also about personal, bodily, or microcosmic equivalents. That's straight out of Mary Douglas, of course. Body, society, diet. Thus, in Leviticus, there is all sorts of legislation concerning pure, impure, clean, unclean, or simply in and out, concerning bodily orifices. And orifices are all right. You can sort of count them and legislate for them. They're like your boundary crossings, your customs posts. What, however, if you could not tell an orifice from a surface? What if surfaces began to rot and spot and sort of break open anywhere? You're turning into sort of all orifice, as it were. That is exactly the nightmare that haunts the purity system. If you can't tell orifice from surface, you can't any longer legislate for orifice. Leprosy, using the term that we normally use, that's the problem. I translated as scaliness, mildew, or rot, and maybe flakiness would have the right moral connotation. What's interesting is in Leviticus, it attacks the three standard separating boundaries of skin, clothes, and wall. You can find this, so this should warn us, it's got nothing to do with leprosy. Walls, even in the ancient world, didn't get leprosy. Above all, however, it legislates the person with boundaries so afflicted into quarantine. Now, whatever the actual disease is, the illness, was the separation from family and village, a fate very close to death in Mediterranean society where you took your dignity and your worth and your very being from the eyes of others. That was the illness, and that was what Jesus healed. As I understand it, immediately, in the parables of the historical Jesus, often we speak a world of radical egalitarianism, which discrimination and hierarchy, exploitation and oppression no longer exist. But was that ideal dream accompanied by any social program? Was it all an act of ecstatic imagination and rhapsodic vision, or did it also contain policies, plans, procedures for communal implementation? If Jesus was a matter of both words and deeds, and we talk only of words, it is as if, to use two American examples, we discuss Abraham Lincoln primarily or exclusively in terms of the Gettysburg Address, and admired, of course, its rhetoric, and Martin Luther King Jr. primarily or exclusively in terms of the Washington Mall speech, and of course also admiring its rhetoric. But in all those cases, there was a program behind the vision, a political challenge behind the soaring rhetoric. It is not just a matter of talk. It is when talk becomes action that people get killed. My conclusion that Jesus had both a vision and a program is based on three independent sources, and that's very important for me, and they are early ones. The first I will quote completely because it's very short. It's from the Gospel of Thomas. When you go into any land and walk about in the districts, if they receive you, eat what they will set before you and heal the sick among them. Eat and heal. Watch that conjunction in all three texts. The second one is from Q. That is, for those of you who haven't had the pleasure of meeting it, when scholars noticed that Mark was copied into Matthew and Luke, they also noticed that there were parts in Matthew and Luke that were not derived from Mark. And they called it Q for quaint. Carry no purse, no bag, no sandals, and salute no one on the road. Enter a house, peace be to you. If the Son of Peace is there, your peace rests upon him, if not, he returns. Remain in the same house, eating and drinking. When you enter a town, I'm just hitting the key passages, eat what is set before you, heal the sick, and say to them, the kingdom of God is come. Eat and heal. And finally, there is the one in Mark. Take nothing for your journey except the staff. Staff is allowed. No bread, no bag, no money in your belt, but wear sandals. Which is a warning, by the way, that these were serious, because nobody tells you you can wear sandals unless somebody told you before that you couldn't. Said to them, when you enter a house, stay until you leave the place. If anyone wants to receive you, shake off the dust. So they went out and preached that men should repent. And they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many that were sick and healed them. And Mark does not say eat, but he says to stay in the house. Jesus called his practice and program the presence of the kingdom, or better, the rule of God, but that expression should be interpreted primarily in the light of those actions. It did not mean for Jesus, as it could for others, the imminent apocalyptic intervention of God to set right a world taken over by evil and injustice. It meant the presence of God's kingdom here and now in the reciprocity of open eating and open healing, in lives, that is, of radical egalitarianism on both the socio-economic eating and the religio-political healing levels. All three sources indicate that we are not just dealing with almsgiving. I cannot emphasize this too much, but with what anthropologists call commensality, with who you eat with, when you eat, as so far as that forms a miniature map of society. Jesus does not tell them to take handouts at the door. He tells them, you must eat with those you heal. Commensality is not almsgiving. Almsgiving is not commensality. Generous almsgiving may even be conscience's last great refuge against the terror of open commensality. What we have here is a strategy for building or rebuilding peasant community on radically different principles from the grassroots up. Open eating and open healing are reciprocally linked in all three sources. I understand healing, in terms of Jesus, within the basic distinction made in cross-cultural medical anthropology between those who cure disease and those who heal illness. And I find, by the way, that this distinction was absolutely incomprehensible to my undergraduate students until some of them saw the movie Philadelphia. Now they understand exactly the difference between disease and illness. That the disease is that virus that can be seen under a microscope, and the illness is everything else that interacts with it. Your relationship to yourself, the relationship of the man he was living with, the relationship of his family, the relationship of his law firm, the relationship of the court system, everything to him. That is the illness. It's caused by and reciprocally causes part of the illness by breaking down your immune system. Let me take an example from Jesus' encounter with the leper and try and keep that analogy with AIDS. What are we talking about? We're certainly not talking about leprosy. That's agreed by all scholars. That's not what we're talking about. That was known in the ancient Roman world as Eliphas. You can imagine why. What we're talking with leprosy is something like psoriasis, some kind of a scaly skin disease or rash. Now what's going on here? Legislators seeking to protect a society's status endangered by imperial engulfment in a small society like Israel, not only legislate very carefully about social, national, or macrocosmic boundaries, but also about personal, bodily, or microcosmic equivalents. That's straight out of Mary Douglas, of course. Body, society, diet. Thus, in Leviticus, there is all sorts of legislation concerning pure, impure, clean, unclean, or simply in and out, concerning bodily orifices. And orifices are all right. You can sort of count them and legislate for them. They're like your boundary crossings, your customs posts. What, however, if you could not tell an orifice from a surface? What if surfaces began to rot and spot and sort of break open anywhere? You're turning into sort of all orifice, as it were. That is exactly the nightmare that haunts the purity system. If you can't tell orifice from surface, you cannot any longer legislate for orifice. Leprosy, using the term that we normally use, that's the problem. I translate it as scaliness, mildew, or rot, and maybe flakiness would have the right moral connotation. What's interesting is in Leviticus, it attacks the three standard separating boundaries of skin, clothes, and wall. You can find this, so this should warn us, it's got nothing to do with leprosy. Walls, even in the ancient world, didn't get leprosy. Above all, however, it legislates the person with boundaries so afflicted into quarantine. Now, whatever the actual disease is, the illness was the separation from family and village, a fate very close to death in Mediterranean society, where you took your dignity and your worth and your very being from the eyes of others. That was the illness, and that was what Jesus healed. As I understand it, immediately the disease, let's say psoriasis, just to keep it simple, was not cured. And he healed it by refusing to accept the official quarantine, by refusing to stay separate from the sick person, by touching him and thereby confronting others with a challenge and a choice. By so doing, of course, he was making extremely subversive claims about who defined the community, who patrolled its boundaries, who controlled its entries and exits, who, in plain language, was in charge. Jesus and his followers healed illness. The basic illness of an exploited peasantry in a colonial society and everything that came from it. They never, in my opinion, cured disease except when and if it happened indirectly to the former and much more important social process. And of course, when such actions got Jesus into serious trouble, it was certainly not, as the authorities would have understood very clearly, for practicing medicine without a license. Finally, in the kingdom movement, the healers make house calls. Healing is shared freely in the only way it is truly free for a peasant. It comes to you.